Blog Talk Radio.
All right, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the STEM Files on Blog Talk Radio, where we highlight the best and brightest in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I'm your host and Chairman and Chief Science Officer of Original Man Scientific. I'm joined by my co-host.
Yes, sir. Peace and blessings, family. This is Jabril Muhammad, co-host of the STEM Files, also Vice Chairman of Original Man Scientific and Materials Engineer in a field of auxiliary systems.
Praise be to Allah. Thank you, Jabril, for joining me again. This is the second weekend where we've had back-to-back episodes in one weekend, so I'm excited about it.
Yes, sir.
Is part two. Yes, sir. This is part two of Legends of Kemron, where we sit down and discuss a variety of topics with Victor Muhammad. Brother Victor, how are you, sir?
I am well. I cannot complain. God is great.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Thank you again for joining us for part two of this amazing dialogue. We want to actually go right ahead into getting to know a little bit, just kind of continuing on from the last interview. If anybody wants to listen to the last interview, you can go and just about two episodes back, season two, episode 15, Legends of Kemron, part one, and you can get to know Victor from the biomedical side. Today, we're going to go into the animal science and agricultural side of our brother's career and our brother's life. So, Brother Jabril, you want to go ahead and take it away from there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, as we all know, we spoke a lot last show, for those who listened, on, you know, Kemron and Brother Victor's, you know, work with that, his history, as well as biomedical aspects of other things. And I guess going into this show, we focus on the agricultural aspect of things, animal science. Brother Victor, I guess for all those listening, what, as we go through and talk to you today, would you like to most take away from your commentary and our exchange on tonight's show?
Well, thank you. That is a good question. And I think what would help the listeners understand is if we identify what we intend by Kemron, because we talked on the periphery last week about it, but yeah, I did not give any specific details about it. We talked about a product, but I'm sure many people, especially people probably in their 20s, might not know what Kemron is. And then I think I can segue that into the relationship between Kemron and animal science.
So, absolutely.
What is Kemron? Kemron is the original product that is a substance called interferon alpha. What is Kemron? It is a version of the interferon alpha that was developed by Dr. David Koech at the Kenyan Medical Research Institute in Nairobi, Kenya, back in the 1980s. Dr. Koech was a black scientist, a black medical doctor, and he had read about a treatment where a veterinarian in the U.S. was using interferon alpha to treat a cow disease that was caused by viruses. And Dr. Koech read of this veterinarian treating these calves with this interferon alpha. And what Dr. Koech did, he had a large patient load of prostitutes in Nairobi who had contracted HIV back in the 1980s. And what Dr. Kowich did, he started using interferon alpha, the natural version of it. And he started with a high concentration of interferon alpha. And he continued to reduce the dosage of interferon alpha. Interferon alpha is a cytokine, and that means cyto, tissue, kind to move. So this is a protein that moves across the cells inside the body. And what he did, he continued to reduce the concentration of interferon until he until the patients reported an increase in appetite. So when they reported an increase in appetite, Dr. Kowich suspected that he had found the correct dosage concentration for the patient. And that was around 150 to 250 international units per cc, or cubic centimeter,
yes,
or milliliter. And he began giving them that dosage, and he found that the women to whom he was given the concentration began to respond, and their viral load began to decrease. They increased, their appetite was increased. And in the male patients, once he started treating male patients, he found that in addition to an increase in appetite, an increase in weight gain in male patients, he reported an increase in libido. And this is how he, at that point, he contacted, I believe, Hayashibaro's laboratories in Nagasaki, Japan. And they produce lozenges for Dr. Kowich at a concentration of approximately 200 international units per lozenge or pill. And I believe another version was produced in Australia. I think that may have been called Immunex or Immuviron. But it was all a low-dose natural interferon alpha product. Now, why do we use the word natural? Because if you check the pharmaceutical companies around this country and perhaps the world, you won't find very many versions of natural interferon alpha. The majority of them are synthetic or recombinant.
Right.
What is intended by recombinant or synthetic is the gene that codes for interferon alpha in the body was isolated, meaning it was found, taken out of the genome, probably of something like a cow, and that was placed inside a bacteria, and the bacteria was placed in a cell culture medium. When you place it in a cell culture medium and bring the medium up to a temperature of about 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 degrees Celsius, then the bacteria begins to reproduce itself. And when you incorporate the gene for interferon alpha in the bacteria genetic makeup, when the bacteria reproduces itself, it also reproduces the interferon alpha. But what we found is that the recombinant version or the synthetic version is not as the activity. And I won't go into that because that's a lot of biochemistry. But we found that the synthetic version does not present the same effectiveness of the natural version. And there is a reason for that, but that's covered under a science called immunohistochemistry and immunology. But that's somewhat the history in a nutshell. It really isn't the history, but it gives you a synopsis of how that name came about. So Kimron is just a brand name of interferon alpha. That's all it is. Animal science is the science that was used to first understand the clinical properties of interferon alpha. Interferon alpha was first discovered back in the late 1950s. And I believe the veterinarian who used it did so in the late 70s, early 80s. And Dr. Kowich read this in one of the medical journals about this veterinarian's use of interferon. And he, well, I've already covered that. But this was done in cattle by a veterinarian who was also an animal scientist. Now, what
yes,
is
sir.
The necessity of what is the necessity of animal science? Animal science is the it's found in agriculture, and it is the science of food and fiber production utilizing animals. So you're producing medicines, you're producing drugs, you're producing meat, you're producing byproducts, you're producing milk and dairy products, you're producing eggs, rabbits, you're producing poultry, you're producing leather and other skins and hides and furs. All these things come under the category or that branch of science or agriculture called animal science. And animal science is the husbandry of animals where an individual, a human, takes an animal, places that animal in an environment where it can be nurtured and it can be manipulated so that that animal will either produce food or fiber for human consumption or human use. I know that was a lot.
Oh, no, sir. We were definitely, you answered questions that we were actually going to ask. Brother Jabril, did you have something you wanted to add real quick? Brother Jabril, you still on?
Yes, sir. I'm
okay,
here. Sorry. I think I had it on mute last
minute.
Yes, sir. I'm
all
good.
Right.
So I guess that's an awesome segue, and thank you for, like, breaking down that Chemron and interferon alpha, sir. I think it gives a wonderful background and backdrop to what we're going to go into. But I guess going more into animal science, you mentioned the overall production. You talked about eggs and the rabbits, the fibers, being able to properly to the food supply in the animal kingdom in a sense to meet the needs and applications of humanity. So how does one in your field, I guess, work to develop efficient ways to produce those things from like meat, you know, poultry, eggs, and dairy products? So we know that when it comes to yields and just people are so overly concerned with, you know, the food supply and, you know, GMOs and things being in and out of season or not being able to produce those things. So how does one develop efficient methodologies for production of those things?
Well, there are a multitude of mechanisms in place and systems in place to produce meat and meat products and other commodities that come from animal husbandry. What we are doing is we've reached a point in the world today where some of the methodologies that have been developed in the last 100 years may not be the best methods for producing meat and meat products. We have data today, scientific data that's have been tested against mathematics and statistics that demonstrate that some of the mechanisms and measures for producing meat and meat products and such things are done so in a manner that it has become deleterious to human and other life forms. So today we are in the process, those like myself and some of the teams that we have put together and are putting together to come up with and develop new ways of producing meat products that don't have the toxicity, that don't have the cancerous causing properties to it that are clean. If you were to see, visit some of the farms around this country, some of the facilities around this country where animals are being raised for human consumption, you would probably find it unbelievable that people are actually raising animals in some of these forms. And and when you so me coming from an agricultural background at the collegiate level, doing research at the collegiate level, all the way up to the level of PhD, then going from agriculture into biomedical research, then you get to see both ends of the cause and effect of how some animals are raised. So I got to be a part of how animals are produced and how meat and meat products and dairy products are produced. Then as a biomedical research scientist, I got to see some of the effects of how these animals are raised. So many of the diseases from which humans and other animals suffer today has a direct correlation with the way animals are raised. The antibiotics that are given to beef cows, the dewormers that are given to beef cows have been found to kill the dung beetle, the animal that pretty much catabolizes the waste from beef cows so that it can return to the soil. And what we have found, and this is published in referee journals, what we found is that the dewormer that has been given to beef cows to get rid of worms so that they can gain weight relatively fast, and quite honestly, some of those worms will kill the cow if it's not treated. But it also kills the dung beetle. And because of that, now you have the waste from the cow, it just sits on the ground, whereas before it would be catabolized and it returns to the soil. And there are some cancers that can be traced back to some of the additives that go on meat, some of the additives that are in meat, some of your processed meat. So what we have done and are doing is we've decided that it is time that people like ourselves develop, purchase land, and began to grow some of our own meat for people who don't want that kind of. And this is the kind of thing that we're presenting to the community and the country. So if you want to work and begin to produce your own meats and your own vegetables that are clean, and you don't have to be concerned with things like this, then this is why this is something that you can now participate in, because we're making it available to you.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned something key, and you're talking about the cow, and I think I want to ask a quick question in relation to milk. There was a post on social media, and you know how, you know, there's no real grounds for fact a lot of times people's posts, but a brother or someone I didn't know was posting a picture that showed what was supposed to be milk. It was like red in this bag, and he was saying, like, you know, this is what milk looks like before it's whitened and things of that nature. It's like full of blood and pus and things of that nature.
Yeah,
could you speak to the nutritive properties of milk, particularly from a cow properly raised or at the proper stage, and also the different look or properties of milk of a cow at certain stages, like whether it's sick, if it's pregnant, if it's, you know, I guess, out of season or younger. Could you speak to that a little bit, to what you've kind of come into contact with?
Yes, sir. Well, milk has two major components, constituents, that is water and fat. That is, those are the major components of milk. Now, milk is produced in the mammary system of any and every mammal. I don't know what it was that this individual was showing on the whatever the website or whatever he had it. I don't know what he was showing, but the mammary system does not intersect with the bloodstream, nor does it intersect with the digestive system. It is a separate system that is in the abdomen of the cow, but it is a system that is clear and distinct from other systems. So that those things, unless someone lacerated the mammary gland, which allows blood to enter, or I don't know what the other constituent you said was in it, but it would have to be lacerated or cut or perforated some way for that to get in it. Otherwise, the two, that system is complete, clear, and distinct from the other systems. And the major benefit of the feeds that are fed to a cow, if you want milk volume, let's say if you want to increase the sheer volume of milk that a cow produces, then you feed it more plant material like corn, and you cut up the entire corn plant, the corn cob, the kernels, the leaves, the stalk. You cut up everything, and you chop and you feed this to the cow. That increases the volume of milk. If you want to increase the fat content in milk, then you feed the cow what is called concentrate. And concentrate is made up of things like soybean meal and other things that are very high in energy. That increases the milk fat. And so those dairy farmers who may have a contract with ice cream companies, cottage cheese companies, that butter companies who want more fat, then they feed the animal more concentrate as opposed to more plant material. Does that answer your question? Did I cover it?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's something I really didn't know, like how to really change the properties of milk or to yield or to help whatever you know, partnerships or whatever your end goal is. So that's very key. And I think on that, just like the last thing I think I talked about, that is it true, or that I guess depending on the stage the state of being that the cow is in, you can have milk, you know, obviously of different like tastes or different colors or looks. What are some examples of those, you know, states of being? And how can, like, you know, a farmer or someone who has cows kind of steer clear of the cow being in the wrong state?
Milk doesn't have a state. By the time the milk leaves the teat, it's white. Now, you have cows like the Guernsey, the Jersey, the milking brown Swiss. These animals have, especially the Jersey, these animals have very high butterfat content. So when you milk them and the milk is chilled, see, once you milk the cow, the milk goes from the milking parlor through a lot of pipes inside the dairy to what are called holding tanks. These holding tanks may hold at least 1,000 to 2,000 or 3,000 gallons of milk, and they are refrigerated to about 42 or less degrees Fahrenheit. While the milk is in the holding tank, it's chilled. it goes from the body temperature of the cow down to a refrigerated temperature. Once the milk is chilled, then you'll see the butter forming on the top of the milk. In the animals, in those breeds like the Jersey, the Guernsey, the milking brown Swiss, they have the high butter fat content, and so you'll see the yellow butter forming at the top of that milk, and so that coloration comes from the butter that's in the milk. But that's going to be in any animal. But the higher the butter fat content, the more yellow tinge the milk is going to have on it once you chill it. So if you look at a buffalo, not the bison that we have here in the United States, that's not a buffalo, that's a bison. But a buffalo is what you find in India, Africa, Asia. And the butter fat content in that is extremely high, you see. And so because that animal has to give its young, it has to gain weight very quickly. So you need a very high butter fat content so that the baby of that animal will gain weight quickly. And that, the only other way you would have a discoloration to milk that I am aware of, and my PhD work was in digestive physiology and ruminant nutrition, and my dissertation work was feeding 100 lactating Holstein cows bovine somatotropin hormone and rumen inert fats to see if these things had an effect on the volume of milk that the Holsteins produced and the butterfat content that the Holstein produced. The Holstein is the big black and white cow that you see on the Chick-fil-A commercials. That's a Holstein.
Yes, sir.
And they don't encourage you to eat more chicken. That's not true. I'm sorry. I had to say that. But...
Yes, sir.
But the only other variable that influences the coloration of milk is a disease called mastitis. And mastitis is a bacteria that sometimes get into the udder of the cow, and that will cause the milk to turn yellow. And will also cause the milk to, when it leaves the teat. So when you're milking and you see that the milk is coming out in little clumps or it has a yellow tinge to it, then you immediately remove the milker from that cow. You shut off the milking machine, and any milk that has gone into the milking parlor, you let it run out on the floor and go down the drain, because the whole milk is the whole system is now contaminated, because mastitis. People, if you drink milk that contains mastitis, it does cause sterility in men if you drink it. So a lot of people will argue that when they were growing up and they drink unpasteurized milk. And a lot of people over the years have written me and asked me about drinking raw milk. I say, well, here's what I would say to you. And I wrote an article about this because I got so many questions about it. My response is this: you a grown person, you do what it is you believe you want to do. However, my recommendation to you is never drink raw milk. The reason being is because if you don't know what you're looking for in mastitis or even brucellosis in a cow, but specifically mastitis, if you don't know what you're looking for and you happen to drink some raw milk from a cow that has not been pasteurized and that cow has mastitis, it can cause sterility in men. So you have to be careful.
And that kind of goes back to the Kimron situation, and I'm kind of horsebacking off what Jabril, I had asked about the nutritional value of milk. I've been studying some of Dr. Aleem's lectures and some of his videos on using raw milk for AIDS and HIV. What's your viewpoint on that? Is you're suggesting that we don't drink raw milk? And does that contradict what he was saying about the raw milk, or does it go hand in hand?
I don't know what he said about the raw milk because I've never read it or heard it, so I can't speak on that.
Okay.
But I don't know any properties that is contained in milk that would have an influence on HIV. HIV is caused, HIV is the human immunodeficiency virus. That is a retrovirus, and it works by attaching itself to the DNA inside the chromosome, excuse me, the DNA inside the nucleus of a white blood cell. And it requires two specific enzymes in order to replicate itself. The way the interferon alpha works is that the interferon interferes, hence the name alpha interferon, it interferes with the virus ability to use those two enzymes to replicate itself. So when the virus, when the cell inside your body is ready to divide and duplicate itself, the interferon comes in and interferes with that enzyme's ability to help that virus duplicate itself. So the virus cannot duplicate itself, so that when that virus dies, then it can't reproduce itself. So after a while of all those viruses not being able to reproduce themselves, then the virus, your viral load begins to dissipate and decrease until it becomes non-detectable. Now, beyond that, I can't speak on anything like that because in all my years of studying milk and working with milk, and as I said, my PhD was in the Department of Dairy Science at Ohio State University. And I worked as the assistant manager of the dairy farm at the master's level when I was in graduate school. And so all the properties of milk that I know, I don't know of any that would have an influence on a viral infection. I don't know of any. So you would have to tell me something in order for me to respond to it.
Okay. Yes, sir. I'll definitely come back to you, come back around to that question. But I kind of want to go more into, get a little bit broader with it in terms of agriculture and the AIDS and HIV virus. How do you see agriculture on the grand scheme of things influencing the level of the death rates and the rate of contraction with these types of viruses? How do you see agriculture interfering with those different things? Or people using agriculture to heal themselves from these issues?
Well, I think that if the average person in the medical sciences and biomedical sciences, pharmaceutical sciences, and even pathology, a pathologist, the average and persons like myself who are farmers, in addition to being a biomedical researcher and an agricultural researcher, I'm also a farmer. And so I can speak from either of those angles, and I can also merge them together and extrapolate and give you a perspective that's going to be pretty accurate. Now, each of these endeavors, each of these fields of human endeavor, biomedical, medicine, pharmaceutical, pathology, agriculture, and mortuary science, each of these fields of endeavor come in contact with the human being at some point, and they come in contact with the health of the human. I work, it's I worked as an environmental analyst with the United States Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. My job was to write environmental impact statements and environmental assessments on things like genetically engineered tomatoes, genetically engineered tobacco, genetically engineered corn and soybean. I wrote environmental impact statements on the effect of malathion, which is a herbicide, on the black howler monkey, the spider monkey in Belize and Guatemala, and a whole lot of other things. Now, what you will find is that when you began studying different forms of cancer in the human, you will find that a lot of those cancers, and you just have to go and search Medline, Agricola, LexisNexis. These are databases that contain referee journals on different articles that have been published by scientists. And you will find that there are correlations between the way vegetables are raised. You'll find that there are correlations and direct relationships between the way meats are raised and animals are raised for meat. Why is it necessary for there to be a phenomenon called halal meats? Why is it necessary for there to be a phenomenon called kosher meats? Why is this necessary? Because if an animal is not slaughtered in a halal or kosher manner, then what you do, you're actually murdering it. Right. And when you murder any life form, it doesn't have to be an animal that you have on a farm, but any life form, as soon as that life form senses a threat, then it begins to excrete in its in its physiology, in the endocrine system, it begins to excrete different toxins in the body because the animal got to figure out, what do I need to do in order to survive? The animal becomes frightened, and just like you and I, when we become frightened, our body, the brain, begins to produce different chemicals, different drugs, and different proteins and other things that, in some instances, are very toxic. And likewise, when you have a slaughterhouse and these animals can hear the other animals bellowing inside the slaughterhouse, these animals are not stupid. The cow might be stupid, but it's not stupid. The cow saying, the ones that are still in the holding pen is saying, wow, listen to that birther in there screaming. What are they doing to her, you know? Or listen at Bill in there, you know. We were just on the truck together, and I hear Bill in there bellowing. He's saying, wait a minute, what are you all doing to me, you see? And so the other animals that are still out in the holding pens hear what's going on. And if you don't believe that they are afraid, visit a slaughterhouse sometime. Or you can come onto a farm where we may be putting ear tags in the ears of the cow, the goat, or the sheep so that we can identify them. And when you put them in the pen so that you can restrain them, they start bellowing, and the other animals become restless. Also, I don't know how to say this, when we want to collect, this is a science discussion, so, I mean, everybody on the call understands this is a science discussion. So when we are ready to collect semen from a bull, we put the bull in what is called a catch chute, and you squeeze it so that he can't move. Then you get a few 2x4s, and place it underneath the bull's stomach so that he won't fall when you start to. Then you put on a glove to come all the way up to your shoulder. You reach in, you go down, and you find the bull's prostate gland, and you begin to massage the prostate gland with your hand. When you do this, the bull will excrete semen. You catch semen in a glove and inside a container, and this is how you collect semen and sperm from the bull. If you want to test the bull's test the viability of the sperm to see if this bull is good, or whether or not his sperm is viable, then this is the way you collect it. If you want, if you've got a $100,000 prize Black Angus bull, and you want to be able to sell his semen for artificial insemination, this is the way you collect it. You put it in straws, you put it in liquid nitrogen, then you ship it all over the world and sell it for $250 per straw. And but when the point that I'm making is, when you do this, the bull starts screaming, well, not screaming, but bellowing, because he's not accustomed to somebody putting on a glove and reaching in and reaching down into his abdomen, picking up the prostate gland and massaging it. So the other bulls that are waiting their turn, they hear him bellowing and they become restless and start bellowing. So it's just, it's like a lot of commotion. So this is why the science of halal, for people who refer to themselves as Muslim, and the science of kosher, for people who refer to themselves as Jews, this is why this science was developed, so that a humane methodology can be utilized to sacrifice your animal without murdering the animal and scaring it to death, so that now you're eating meat, and that meat was humanely slaughtered. It wasn't murder. And that's why that's why these sciences are necessary, and that's why in America we need to spend more time making the public aware that you have options, and there are options available for your food consumption. So we see the aggression and anger. We see an unusual type of aggression in America. From where does it come? You see, there a correlation with this? You're eating meat that was murdered. You see, so when you consume this meat, does it have a physiological effect on you and me? Well, I would say yes, it does. I won't go into that now because that's a whole show by itself. But this is part of the reason that people like us have to now begin to develop ways of slaughtering and, well, producing first and then slaughtering meat for those of us who eat meat, that meat may be clean and that meat may be healthy for you, and that you will not and should not be having deleterious effects coming from you consuming this meat.
Right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, it definitely goes back to Hadith to Live, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said that the way they prepare the animals for consumption goes into you, and you become you start taking on characteristics of what that animal went through. You start becoming aggressive, you start becoming argumentative, just all negative characteristics that any person can take on. When you think about what was said in Hadith to Live, and then how much you've studied when it comes to animal science, how often were you able to, did you know about Hadith to Live while studying animal science, or did that come after?
It came after. When I first heard the teachings of Islam, It was 1988, and that's when I was pursuing my PhD at Ohio State. And but I didn't know about How to Eat to Live until 2 years later, in 1990. But once I read How to Eat to Live, I accepted it 100% because verified everything that I had learned at the bachelor's level, the master's level, and the PhD level in animal science and agriculture. It verified it, you know.
Right.
And so I accepted it 100%. I had no arguments with it because I had already studied all of this when I was in grad school and undergrad. I'll give you another example. When I was in undergrad, I took a course called Meat and Meat Sciences and another course called Livestock Disease and Sanitation. Now, in this course, we visited a slaughterhouse where they also produced byproducts like ham and other cold cuts and sausages and things like that. Now, what we did, this was a slaughterhouse for pigs, hogs, and we went on the kill floor. It's called the kill floor. On the kill floor, in these, I guess you would call them like holding pens, and a rope came down from the ceiling. There were two people on the kill floor. One man put the rope around one of the hind legs of the pig. The pig was hoisted into the air. Another man walked around with a sharp knife and a file. And he just walked around, and while the pig was being pulled and hoisted and elevated in the air about shoulder length to the man would walk up and raise the pig's left arm, left leg, and stab the pig in the heart. And you would see, obviously, blood would start gushing from the pig's wound because he stabbed him directly in the heart. The objective with that, with turning the pig upside down and holding him in the air from the hind leg, was so that the heart would be lower than the rest of the body, so that through gravity, you would first of all, the heart is still pumping, so it's pumping. As it's pumping, it's getting rid of the blood because now the valves in the heart are now open, and instead of the pressure being used to press the blood throughout the pig's body through the arterial system, it is now being pumped directly out of the body. So you're killing two birds with one stone. You're getting the blood out of the animal, but you're also killing the animal at the same time. So by the time the animal dies, you don't have to wait for the blood to drain because the pig's heart already pumped it out. And then the animal is then using the same rope he's taken over to the table where he's put into a steam tank where the hair is removed from his body. And, you know, and then he's gone in and they turn him into sausages. And if it's depending on the breed, he's turned into bacon, or depending on the breed, the hams are taken from him because some are bred specifically for hams. Some pigs, like the Landrace, it's bred specifically for the bacon because it has a long body. And, you know, whatever the breed may have been developed for, that's what they use them for. Right. And so now you're eating sausages and ribs on the 4th of July from animals that were murdered. So in addition to eating the trichina worm that the pig contains, now you're eating the violence with which the animal was killed. Mm-hmm. And so when you go out on the streets of America and look at the people, well, do you see any of those characteristics in the people exhibited?
Yes, sir.
Am what I'm saying just exercises in oratory. I think that you will agree with me. When you study the people, the behavior of the people, you'll see those characteristics.
Right. You know, on that point, I know we're taught so scientifically about how to eat food or take in that which is good for us. And I know on our show yesterday, I was speaking to the young lady and guest about diet and it being more than physical, but also mental and spiritual, and the power of truth versus when you ingest a lie and things of that nature. But particularly when it comes to physical food, can you speak to, you know, in America at least, you know, when it comes to eating, people are so overly concerned, or people put on simply food's nutritional value. So, okay, nuts, for example, high in protein, or like pork loin, it has protein value. Yeah, that's true. But then people discount or don't understand the fact that there are other health aspects to, you know, to these foods, or there are things about the food that hinder your ability to absorb that which may be in it of good. So can you speak to, like, a more holistic view of eating and it being more than counting calories or the nutritional value where it is, if it's folic acid, fiber, protein, and things of that nature?
Well, that's a very good question. And in the 35 years that I've been involved in food and fiber production, biomedical research, farming, and nutrition and diet, what I hear mostly, whether it's in print media, whether it's radio, television, your so-called experts on TV, I hear mostly comes under what we as scientists refer to as dogma. Now, what is dogma? The definition of dogma is to say something as though it's factual when you have no evidence or proof to support your claim. And most of what you hear being reported as this being good for you, that being good for you, oh, you need to have this in your diet, there is no scientific basis for that. How do you know? Well, many people eat nuts. Now, human beings cannot digest nuts. So it doesn't matter how much of this vitamin or that mineral or this is in a nut, you can't digest it. Humans don't contain the lipases, which is an enzyme that is necessary to digest nuts. First of all, well, how do you know that, Victor Muhammad? Well, when you want to test whether or not something is digestible, there is a technique that can be used to test that. When we wanted to know what feedstuff was efficiently and effectively digested in the rumen of a cow, a cow does not have two stomachs. A cow only has one stomach, but the stomach has four compartments, and they have specialized jobs that they perform. Those four compartments are called the rumen, the reticulum, the omasum, and the abomasum, and they perform specific jobs. Now, when we wanted to know if something were digestible, and you can do this at home, what we would do, we would bring the cow into the barn, and we would tie her up, and we would not feed her for 2 days. We would do a surgical implant. And we would cut a hole in the cow's side, and we would insert what is called a cannulus. What the cannulus allowed us to do was, you could open the cannulus and reach into the cow's stomach while the cow is still alive. So you can actually see food coming down the cow's esophagus into the stomach. And we could reach in and pick this food up because the cow is still alive now. And what we would do, we would weigh the food before the cow ate it.
Mm.
And we would measure exactly and precisely how much water we permitted her to drink. That way, we knew the weight of everything that went into this cow's system. And we would place a bag on the back of the cow to catch everything that she excreted. Then we would take it into the lab, dry it, heat it, and that way it removed all the water. And then we would weigh it. And if there was a decrease in the weight of the excreted material, then we knew that some of it was digestible.
Right.
You see how scientific and mathematical that is?
Yes,
yes sir.
You see,
yes, sir.
You don't have to argue about that. There is no debating that, because you can't debate that. Nothing to debate. And if the same amount of material that exited the cow is the same as what it weighed when we put it in her mouth, then we know that nothing is digestible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
You see?
On that point, I'm sorry, sir. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That's it.
Oh, yes. So on that point, and talking about math, was there a percentage of weight loss or whatever that you all looked at to determine if said food was good for the cow or good for consumption? Because what I'm thinking is, okay, let's say if the weight was less, but it was like, okay, it didn't meet the threshold that we were hoping for. So that's not something that we want to be found, you know, giving the cow or having being for the consumption of the creature in question.
Well, it depended on what the thesis was before you began the experiment, because when you design the experiment, you already know that for which you're searching, that for which you're investigating. What is it that you want to know at the end of it? And that's how you design it. So if I want to know if human beings can digest collard greens, turnip greens, mustard greens, then what I would do, I would have the person to fast for about 2 days and drink only water and coffee. And on the third day, I would weigh the collard greens, the turnip greens, the mustard greens. And I would feed them to the person and give them water. Then in about 8 hours, I would catch in some container what they excrete. Then using the same type of experiment and the same type of apparatus that I described with the cow, you would weigh after you ran the material through the requisite desiccators and the things you need to extract the water from it, and you would weigh it to see if there's a difference in the weight. If the weight is the same, then you know that humans can't digest collard greens, turnip greens, and mustard greens. If there's a reduction in the weight, then you know it can. But I believe that if you perform that experiment, I believe you would find that when you weigh it, it will weigh the same.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds definitely like a good experiment to do.
Now, you hear a lot of people on television, radio, newsprint, doing discussions on how this is good for you and how that's good for you. I have an anecdote for that. The next time you hear someone say what is good for you, then you politely say, why? Or how? And I would venture out to say, I doubt very seriously if they can tell you why this is good for you. Because many of the things that people say are good for you, they are not. And they cannot tell you how, because there is nothing that makes it good for you. The human being, as we said last week, last Sunday, the human body is designed to be a machine that runs very efficiently on a small number of things. That is wheat bread, navy beans, if you choose to eat navy beans. But the human body can run very, very, very functionally, efficiently on whole wheat bread and whole milk. Now, eating all of this other stuff, sometimes I listen to people and what they say they eat. And it's ridiculous. It's outright ridiculous at the things that people eat and the volume of food that people eat. Food volume is not a replacement for food specificity. What do you mean?
Say that again.
Victor,
yes.
Muhammad?
Go ahead.
That's right.
Food volume is not a replacement for food specificity. Now, what do you mean by that? You can eat 100 pounds of food, and I can eat 4 spring rolls. And I'm not advocating this, but I do it sometimes because I work so
right.
much that sometimes I just don't feel like eating or
right.
cooking. So I'll go to the Chinese restaurant in the next town over from me, and I'll get a bowl or a cup of hot and sour soup, which is mostly
yes.
just liquid with some bean sprouts and some something. I don't know what's in it. It's all vegetable.
Yes,
you know, and I'll get two orders of spring rolls. And if you know what spring rolls are, they're like egg rolls,
right.
but they just got cabbage in it.
Right.
And it's good to eat the white leaves of cabbage, not the green, but the white. If you test the green leaves of a cabbage, it actually feels like a piece of leather. But if you test the white leaves, they're very easy to crack up. They're very easy to crush, you see, because it's mostly water. But the green leaves, I mean, it's like filling a leather jacket or something. So
right.
I eat one meal a day, but in the last 30 years, I eat one meal a day. In the last 20 years, 15 to 20 years, I eat about 3 times a week.
Mm.
And not 3 times a day, 3 times a week.
Mm.
And a lot of
yes,
times
sir.
That meal is that bowl of hot and sour soup and 4 spring rolls. And that's all I eat. And I still go out on the farm, and I have animals, and I'll go out on the farm and I'll build fences. I'll plant grass. I'll throw down calves and put tags in their ear if they need to be castrated. Most of the times, I don't have anybody to help me, so I'll grab the calf. And this is a bull calf now. I'll grab the calf, throw him down, and tie his legs up, castrate him, sew him up with the suture, and, you know, by myself. You see. Then I'll go and get 20 bales, 40 bales of hay that weigh about 40 pounds apiece, load it on the truck, bring it home, then unload it, put it in the barn. I'll go and buy 30 bags of feed that weigh 50 pounds each. I'll load them on the truck, then bring them home and unload them all by myself. Then about 4 o'clock, 5:30, I will go and eat the 4 spring rolls and a cup of hot and sour soup. Take a shower, relax,
yes,
and go to bed.
Yes,
and
sir.
Another
yes,
thing I'll
yes,
add, if you study farmers and construction workers, we don't go to the gym.
Right.
You
that,
don't need
yes,
a gym
that's
next
true.
Year.
That's very interesting.
That's true.
Also, if you study farmers and construction workers, we don't need sleep aids. You ain't got to drink a glass of warm milk to go to sleep. You don't have to take Summonex and this sleep aid and that sleep aid and sleeping pills, and you got to – nah, man. If you eat right and take care of your body and get up and do something, and you can stand up and fall asleep.
Right. Right.
So you don't need all these things.
Yep.
Absolutely.
It's funny you mentioned the gym. So I work a pretty sedentary job outside of being on travel as a civilian engineer for the U.S. Navy. And, I frequent the gym, play basketball, lift on occasion, do some calisthenics. But, the amount of people who in the gym, and yeah, they're doing their thing, getting their gym workout, but it's almost like you absolutely have to. Because I feel myself sometimes. I'll be at the desk doing some coursework or whatever, and it's like my legs have been crossed for the last 30 minutes, or I went from an erect position at a right angle to an acute angle, like kind of all the way up at the screen, or we have these standing desks that we use off and on. So all the while, the construction worker has been lifting and pushing and pulling and walking and in the heat or whatever, all day, and the farmhand doing similar things, and it's like they're in some of the best shape just from the multivariant types of movements that they're doing that are not of, a gym type nature. So when you think about that mixed with, eating the right way, you can only imagine the type of shape you'll be in and how your body will respond. And like you said, you shouldn't have issues going to sleep and take melatonin and serotonin and things that you may otherwise need potentially if you work a different type of job, have a different type of schedule. So, yes, sir.
Right. Very important, sir.
Yes, sir.
Definitely, definitely. Well, this has been an excellent part two, Legends of Cameron. I just want to thank you again, Brother Victor, for joining us again tonight on the STEM Files. And we're actually coming towards the end of the show, and there's a few more things we want to ask you. What do you think, in your professional opinion, is the number one problem that black farmers are facing in America from your field of study, and what can the listening audience do to help change the situation?
Oh, wow, now that's an excellent question. Thank you for raising it.
Absolutely.
Last week, if you recall, I mentioned that animal science is the only major in college or university where when the person gets their degree, they can literally go into any field of human endeavor.
Yes, sir.
Now, part of your curriculum in animal science is farm records and accounts, statistics, marketing. You take some business courses. You take computer courses and some other courses that address the business side of farming. Traditionally, the black farmer can do the production side. We grow sweet watermelons. We grow some of the best Angus cattle. We know how to grow a chicken. We know aquaculture, so we can grow fish, all of those things. But the thing that has traditionally hurt the black farmer is the business side. Farming is a business. That's where the word agronomy and the phrase agricultural economics, that's the purpose behind it, you see, because there is an economic side to agriculture, and the black farmer has not been given this benefit since we were so-called freed after slavery. So we've always known how to produce commodities. A commodity is anything produced agriculturally. So we've always known how to produce tomatoes, cucumbers, watermelon, corn. We've always known how to grow these things. But when we go to some of the markets to sell our product, many times you can't get a contract, you see, as a black farmer. I don't want to call any buyers, not right now, because
yes, sir.
I have done this myself in Maryland and in Florida, where I went to a supermarket chain, about four of them in Maryland and three or four down here in Florida. And I said, I represent black farmers. We grow peanuts. We grow tomatoes. We grow watermelons. We grow corn. We've got a total of about 500 acres, and we've got another farmer, a group of farmers that have over 2,000 or 3,000 acres. So we can probably produce any volume of any of these commodities that you need. And they said,
yes, sir.
Well, you know, if you produce this and we need these standards, and if you bring it, we'll buy it from you. And this is where black farmers have been traditionally trapped, because now you've got a person's word of mouth. This particular supermarket chain, this multinational conglomerate that is in every country around the world now. Now, so you go to the bank, you get a loan to grow 500 acres of corn, because these people told you as a black farmer, if you produce this corn and bring it to the distribution warehouse, we'll buy it from you. So now you're $50,000 in debt now, because you got a loan to buy the chemicals you need. The seeds are very expensive. The herbicide is expensive, the pesticide is expensive, and all the other things, your irrigation, you know, you've got the walking gun out in the field that's spraying the water and irrigating. That all costs money.
Right.
So now, in August, you show up at the warehouse with your 18-wheelers full of corn. And they'll send the buyer out, and he'll look over the corn, and he'll find something wrong with it, you see. Or he'll say, well, I mean, you know, Joe, we don't remember telling you that, Joe. I mean, Bill, do you remember telling Joe that we were going to buy? He said, nah, I don't remember, you see. Now,
right.
Mr. Joe got this 18-wheeler load of corn that he has to now try and find something to do with it. There's nothing wrong with the corn. It's just like the Caucasian farmer right down the road. Same corn, you see. But he doesn't have a contract. The black farmer didn't know that he needed a contract or a purchase order, you see. Now he's stuck with this corn. And he can't pay the loan now because he didn't sell the corn. So now he's running the risk of defaulting on the loan, and he can't pay the mortgage on the farm, and now he has to sell the farm, or the bank forecloses on the farm, or something like that. If you go back 100 years, you'll find this happening to black farmers over and over and over, and even to this day, you find the same thing happening to black farmers today. I know, because I was part of a team as early as 2005 and 2006, right here in Florida, where we met with some supermarket chains. We flew to California, San Francisco, to meet with the head office of a supermarket chain on behalf of black farmers right here in Florida and in Maryland.
Yes, sir.
And they would not agree. They would not agree to purchase anything from the black farmers.
Wow. What does it do to the spirit of the black farmer when he's having difficulty securing these business related systems in order to sustain his farm?
Well, it develops and causes a sensation of failure. It begins to cause the black farmer to question his abilities, to question his self-worth, to develop an inferiority complex. So you have two diseases in America, in its two major populations. You have black people in America who are called African Americans, who suffer from a disease called an inferiority complex. This is a disease, and it has and does affect the African American because you're suffering from something that causes you to believe that you are less than someone else. The other disease in America that permeates the society, in the Caucasian people, you have a disease called a superiority complex. I'm better because I'm white, because I'm Caucasian. So now you have a population, you have two populations in one country from people with two extreme diseases. One, an inferiority complex, one, a superiority complex, and both people are ill. What is the difference between sick and ill? We use them interchangeably, but they're not interchangeable. Ill means a disease in your mind. Sick is a biological disease that affects your body, like a cold, a flu, diabetes, pneumonia. That's sick.
Right.
Ill is when the mind is diseased. So they're not interchangeable. And black people in America are ill. And Caucasian people in America are ill. And so both people have to be cured of the disease from which they're suffering. And things like what the black farmers have experienced over the last 100 years since Reconstruction has caused these kinds of complexes in black people, the black farmer. So we've gone from being, I can't remember what USDA cited, the number of acres that black people had in 1900 in America, and by 1990, that number had dwindled to maybe tens of thousands of acres from what it was in the 1900s, where it was in the millions. So what has happened in just over 100 years that has caused black farmers and black people to lose that much acreage? What has that done to the psyche of black people? What has that done to the psyche of the black farmer? What has that done to the psyche of the black male farmer? What does that do to a man when that man is the breadwinner for his family? His family depends upon him, but he can't earn a living from his farm. He's got 500 acres, 600, 1,000, 2,000 acres, but he really can't make anything except he grows watermelons, put them on the back of his pickup truck, and then sits on the side of the highway to sell his watermelons. Well, how are you going to take care of a family selling 200 watermelons or 40 watermelons on the back of your pickup truck, because you can't sell them to a supermarket chain or a multinational conglomerate or anything like that? You see?
Right. You know, and I'm sure you've seen the work that is being done on Muhammad's farms with Dr. Ridgely and the different things that they're doing with all the acres that we have in Georgia. What do you say is one of the most crucial what do you say is something is a crucial point for black farmers to do as a collective to make sure that they're able to capitalize on what their crops can do?
Well, the black farmer has never had an issue when it comes to farming, the production side. The black farmer has always had the problem on the business side of farming, the economic side of farming. In 1922, during the congressional hearings in Washington, D.C., on whether or not to allocate funds to Bill Howard University, during those congressional hearings, the congressman from West Virginia, and this is in the congressional record at the Library of Congress, he stated this: why should we allocate funds to educate the Negro when we will never teach him the science of business, the science of warfare, and the science of mating? Now, why would a learned person like the congressman from West Virginia make such a statement? What is the essence, or what is the necessity of these three sciences? The science of business, warfare, and mating. These are three of the essential sciences that are necessary to make a civilized people. What is civilized?
Yes,
civilized means one having culture, refinement, one having knowledge of all of the sciences of life. What are the sciences of life? The sciences of life are medicine, jurisprudence, law, economics, business, warfare, biology, chemistry, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, aquaculture, you see, politics, religion, literature. These are all sciences of life. And the three of the most essential ones to be an independent people as well as a civilized people are the sciences of warfare, business, and mating. And when you come to the African American community, do you see the results of the lack of these sciences exhibited in the African American community? The answer is a resounding yes. So the black farmer cannot know the science of business, the business side of farming, because that science was strategically kept away from him.
Yes, sir. Well, this has definitely been another episode of the STEM Files that has not only educated listening audience, but I'm sure has inspired some of us to go ahead and get out there and get moving and acquiring land and being real providers for our families. How can those who are listening contact you to help you in your endeavors to bring about a decent and safe community through the life sciences? How can they contact you?
The best contact is, I can give you this number. It's area code 919-798-9736. 919-798-9736. And any questions that you may have, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, is there an email that they can contact you on as well?
Yes, sir. Hold 1 second. It is Victor, V-I-C-T-E-R, dot Muhammad, MUHAMMAD, at gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Brother Victor, so much for your time, your energy, your knowledge, your wisdom, and definitely your enthusiasm as it relates to using the life sciences to build our communities. There's more than one way to institute a final call, and the life sciences and just sciences in general is a way to sound that alarm to our people that it's time to work, time to wake up, and time to work. Brother Jabril, is there anything you'd like to add real quick?
Yes, sir. You know, so again, thank you so much, Brother Victor, for sharing your light, your understanding, your studies with us as it pertains to animal sciences, agriculture, and really a major, major, major area of expertise needed not only for Black America and Blacks all over the world, but the world in general. So definitely thank you for just taking the time out your busy schedule to just shed some light on what we need to be doing. In addition to we want to just point out that Original Man Scientific is always here to serve the community as a primary focus. So for more information relating to Original Man Scientific, you can find us at www.omansci.com, on Facebook at omansci, Instagram at omscientific, and of course the Blog Talk Radio show and all our recordings at blogtalkradio.com/OMS STEM files. All right, so like I said, we live to serve, and we're happy to continue this show and all of our other endeavors. And please, you know, reach out for any assistance that we're looking for, anything from those willing to help financially as well as those willing to help with their research and expertise. So thank you again, sir, and we're looking forward to working with you in the future, helping in any way we can to further your endeavors and move forward for mutual gain.
Thank you, brothers.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. All right, family. Thank you again for tuning in to the STEM Files. This has been The Legends of Qumran, Part 2. We are definitely looking forward to Brother Victor joining us again sometime in the near future. But for right now, we wish you peace and blessings. Brother Jabril, you want to close us out?
Yes, sir. This has been another cracking open of the STEM Files. I'm your co-host, Jabril Muhammad, joined by my host, Tariq Muhammad, and our illustrious guest, if I can say so, Victor Muhammad.
Absolutely. That's right.
Thank you so much for joining us, family. We try to do this every week, and we want to give you the best and brightest and something that you can chew on and share with your family and friends. So with that, we look forward to you listening in next time as we have who, Tariq?
We are having an exercise specialist on. We haven't confirmed which day, Saturday or Sunday, but next weekend we will be having an exercise specialist on the show to go into nutrition and exercise on the physical level and the different sciences that are involved in that. So definitely tune in. The details on that will be forthcoming. So make sure you follow us on Facebook, stay up to date on what we got going on, and. That's pretty much it.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, everyone. Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to, again, another episode of the STEM Files. Peace.